Welcome to the July 2026 News Bulletin podcast for commercial shipping marine surveyors, put together by the International Institute of Marine Surveying. We open our podcast with an introduction from IIAMS CEO Mike Schwartz. Dear member and fellow maritime professionals, the IIAMS Annual General Meeting 2026 was held on the 2nd of June. Often rather dry events, an AGM is a vital part of what any institute or association does once a year. It was a great opportunity to inform and share the many activities being undertaken by IIAMS with an engaged online audience. My thanks to all those who voted this year. Looking at our records, we logged the highest number of votes in memory, and especially to those who took time out from their busy schedules to join us online as we broadcasted the event live from IIAMS HQ at Murrell's House. The management board, many of whom were at Murrell's House in person, were joined by the IIAMS team along with nearly 80 other members online. As I prepared my CEO report ahead of the AGM, it gave me the chance to reflect in depth on the work of the Institute over the last period. There were a couple of highlights in particular I shared with delegates that I want to mention again now for those who were unable to attend. Firstly, IIAMS has paid off the mortgage on Murrell's House, which means we now own the real estate outright, an asset that is estimated to be valued between £800,000 and £1 million. This extraordinary achievement gives me huge personal pride when I think back a dozen years to when I started and how challenging our financial position was then. We have come a long way. To have achieved this still seems unthinkable, and without doubt ranks as one of my proudest accomplishments as CEO. It sets the Institute up financially for the future. The second matter of importance is to inform you about two Lifetime Achievement Awards that were announced and presented at the meeting to two stalwarts and veterans of the Institute. This was one of new president, Mike Proudlove's, first formal duties, and we managed to spring an unexpected surprise on Captain John Noble, who was at the meeting in person. Sadly, John Heath was unable to be present at the event to receive his award. Both men have made not only an outstanding contribution to the maritime sector over half a century, but they have also served IIAMS with distinction for many years. It was great to see both individuals honored and recognized. See elsewhere in this news bulletin for photographs. The good news continues to flow following what proved to be a rather hectic and chaotic June. IIAMS exhibited at this year's SeaWork exhibition, Europe's largest workboat show, held at Southampton from the 9th to the 11th June. It is an event we really do enjoy being part of. Meeting members and other industry personnel is something I very much enjoy, and this year's event proved to be the best and most productive I have attended. Sharing space on the Workboat Association stand, our booth was constantly busy. I was delighted to catch up with so many students, industry friends and colleagues, including those from our competitors too. I have devoted space to this event elsewhere in this news bulletin. Following immediately in the wake of SeaWork was our annual ISO 9001 audit. This year, we decided to extend the scope of our existing certification to bring the IIAMS certifying authority into scope. This meant the audit turned from a one-day event to a two-day event. My thanks to General Manager, Camilla Robertson, who also wears the hat of Quality Manager, and to Dave Parsons, who manages our Certifying Authority Department, both of whom were influential at the audit conducted by DNV auditors. The outcome is that I am delighted to report the existing scope and extended scope have been approved for certification with no major and no minor non-conformities. This is a significant achievement indeed. As we enter the second half of 2026, I want to draw your attention to the high number of incidents and accidents we have seen, many resulting in fatalities sadly. I know to some, I will sound like a broken record, but as we start to prepare and collate edition 6 of the IIAMS Safety and Loss Prevention Compendium, I have to say I am shocked at the continuing high level of loss of life and the sheer number of maritime assets impacted and lost. Of course, highlighting the issue that the industry continues to face is not of much help on its own. Action is needed. What bothers me and is most troubling of all is the repeating nature of some of the incidents. Deaths in enclosed spaces is one such example. Accidents in enclosed spaces continue at an unacceptably high level. 3 more dead in one incident last month alone. Why can't we learn and understand from previous accidents? Is it a lack or training, complacency, lack of common sense, or just a feeling of it won't happen to me? I wish I had the answer. Sticking with the theme of enclosed spaces, I have always been skeptical about remote surveying in general, but the work of Bureau Veritas Marine and Offshore is causing me to think again. Their remote inspection technique uses drones and UAVs operated on board by trained surveyors to inspect hazardous confined spaces like ballast tanks and cargo holds, reducing the need for direct human entry. This approach is designed to improve safety and efficiency compared with traditional inspections, which often require multiple personnel entering high-risk environments. BV estimates RIT can reduce confined space entry risks by 60 to 70%. Now this really is progress, and keeping people out of those spaces can only be a good thing and will save lives. Hurrah! Survey well, Mike. For our first story, we are pleased to announce IAME has accepted IAMS as a member. IAMS is recognized the world over as a leading provider of marine surveying training and education. To further align with the Institute's education aims and aspirations, IAMS has joined and become a member of the International Association of Maritime Institutions. IAME is a global network of maritime training and education providers that delivers training across the maritime sector in merchant navy, superyachts, towing, restricted waters, tonnage, and fishing industries. IAME provide network meetings and conferences to enable our members to collaborate to enhance and expand their training portfolio. IAMS has attended the first regular meeting online and will have in-person representation at the IAME annual conference, which is scheduled to take place in Liverpool, UK, on the 22nd of October 2026. In our next story, the IMO has taken a new step forward towards the safety code for autonomous ships, including comprehensive regulation of unmanned shipping, building upon years of debate and detailed development work. At the latest meeting of the Marine Safety Committee, delegates approved a final text for the Non-Mandatory Maritime Autonomous Surface Ships Code, MASS Code, which codifies a set of safety standards for unmanned vessels in international trade. While the code is only a guideline for now, it is on track to become mandatory as early as 2028, and it gives a sense of what the requirements for unmanned shipping might soon look like in operation. According to IMO, the purpose of the safety code for autonomous ships is to regulate emerging technology and maintain safety while also enabling innovation. Autonomous ships, which entail scaled-up size and risk compared to autonomous boats, are still in their infancy, and this is the first set of specifications that applies globally to their development. The MASS safety code for autonomous ships text has not yet been released, but a marked-up final draft from February shows the committee's intent. For now, the rules are largely goal-based, without the prescriptive specificity of a SOLAS regulation on lifeboat design or AVDR installation. Safe navigation is the first item on the list for evaluating autonomous shipping. The MASS code incorporates by reference the familiar collision avoidance rules of COLREGS, with its human-focused recognition requirements for sounds, lights, shapes, and vessel classes. To complement the standard COLREGS lookout requirement, the MASS code institutes a situational awareness requirement that the ship's self-navigation system must continuously monitor all information necessary for safe navigation. More specific standards, like an ability to evaluate audible sounds and VHF hails, which most autonomous navigation systems cannot currently perform, are as yet not part of the code. The rules do outline a long list of equipment requirements that would be unique, and perhaps technically challenging, for unmanned ships. Without crew aboard, unmanned vessels would need to be designed differently for safety and for emergency response, including fallback operations in reasonably foreseeable degraded states. This implies different standards for structure, subdivision, stability and watertight integrity, fire protection, fire detection and fire extinction, life-saving appliances and arrangements, security, search and rescue, cargo handling, towing and mooring, machinery installations, electrical installations and external support systems. Some of these standards will be challenging to achieve and maintain in a harsh marine environment, just as they are for current equipment. For safety reasons, anchor windlasses will have to be capable of raising and lowering autonomously or remotely during an emergency, without crew to remove the devil's claw or fan the windlass brake. Emergency tow arrangements will have to be configured to be made up without a crew to handle heaving lines and hawsers in rolling seas. Much of the supplier R&D work needed to meet the requirements will continue for years to come. Up next, the US Coast Guard has issued a safety alert after a prototype component used in a mechanical shaft seal system failed on board a Coast Guard-inspected deep-draft vessel. In February 2026, a US-flagged crude oil tanker Transience near Delaware Bay experienced simultaneous failures of its port and starboard shaft seals, resulting in substantial seawater ingress. The crew subsequently deployed emergency collars supplied by the seal manufacturer and used the vessel's emergency bilge system to remove the water. The investigation revealed that the failed component was a prototype composite seal facing material installed during dry dock as part of a shaft seal system previously approved by a recognized organization. Importantly, the investigation found that the RO-approved design drawings lacked specific material details, vaguely describing the seal-facing material only as composite. During the vessel's first post-dry dock voyage, seawater flooded through the seal's split-face butt when exposed to cold seawater after operating in warm conditions. Although the overall seal system was approved by the RO, the seal manufacturer did not disclose its use of the unapproved prototype material. The Coast Guard, RO, and the vessel owner became aware of the substitution only after the incident occurred. Vessel owners and operators are reminded to inform the cognizant USCG office in charge, marine inspection and the applicable RO of any deviations from existing approvals, including prototype or substitute materials, prior to installation. They should also ensure that any novel materials or arrangements that deviate from applicable standards are properly communicated and approved in advance. In our next report, between 2016 and 2025, 17 bulk carriers of more than 10,000 deadweight tons were reported lost, with the tragic loss of 71 seafarers' lives, according to an Intercargo annual report. And cargo liquefaction remains the greatest contributor to loss of life with 37 lives, 52.1% of the total loss of life in the past 10 years. Intercargo's annual bulk carrier casualty report examines the safety performance of bulk carriers over a rolling 10-year period in order to identify risks and improve safety for seafarers and vessel operations. The newest edition also revealed that 4 flooding casualties, 23.5% of the total, cost 34 lives, a significant 47.9% of the total number of lives lost. Groundings also remain the greatest cause of ship losses, with 7 losses or 41.1% of the total. Cargo liquefaction has been the greatest contributor to loss of life, as shown by the 12 reported liquefaction cases since 2009, including 2 casualties involving iron ore fines from India, with the loss of 1 life, 8 casualties involving nickel ore from Indonesia, with the loss of 119 lives, 1 casualty involving bauxite from Malaysia, with the loss of 18 lives, and 1 casualty in 2026, involving nickel ore from the Philippines, with the loss of 6 lives. You can read the update via www.intercargo.org. Next, a degraded rubber expansion joint failed, putting 864 people on board passenger vessel Kaitaki at risk, according to New Zealand's Transport Accident Investigation Commission. TAIC has released its final report 3 years after the Inter-Islander ferry suffered a blackout and loss of propulsion while carrying out a scheduled service between from Picton to Wellington. The incident on the 28th of January 2023 left the ship drifting in strong onshore conditions towards Sinclair Head on Wellington's south coast. The master issued a mayday. The ship avoided grounding after anchors held and power was restored. The immediate cause was the failure of a single degraded component in a safety-critical system. A rubber expansion joint in the engine cooling system ruptured, causing the system to lose most of its water and automatically shut down the engines. The component had exceeded its recommended service life and age limits. The rubber expansion joint had been in service for at least 5 years and was approximately 18 years old. Had Inter-Islander implemented the FMEA recommendations, most importantly replacing all REJs every 2 years, it is very likely that the reliability of the REJs would have been assured. In addition to appropriate management of safety-critical components, the Commission's final report discusses 5 other safety issues, including effectiveness of Inter-Islander's safety management system for onboard engineers, evacuation standards for older ships, emergency response coordination across agencies, access to specialist maritime expertise and decision-making support, and emergency towage and salvage capability for New Zealand. The Commission made 5 recommendations to strengthen system-wide safety. 2 recommendations are for Kiwi Rail to improve preparation and management of engine room emergencies, including implementing and exercising decision support tools for engineers. 3 recommendations are for Maritime New Zealand. They focus on evacuation planning for passenger ferries, national maritime incident readiness and response arrangements, and emergency towage and salvage capability in New Zealand waters. You can read the full report via www.iiamsnewzealand.co.nz. Up next, Transport Canada has launched a concentrated inspection campaign focusing on fire hazard prevention. This CIC applies to for all Canadian vessels over 15 gross tonnage and will run between June 1 and September 1, 2026. The 2026 campaign will focus on various vessel types over 15 gross tonnage that have been certified by Transport Canada or Canadian recognized organizations. The goal of this year's campaign is to make sure that vessels comply with the Canada Shipping Act 2001 and its related regulations. The focus of this concentrated inspection campaign is to review a vessel's condition regarding fire prevention and how well the vessel's master, crew are prepared if a fire was to start on board. During this campaign, Transport Canada will review things like how engine rooms are maintained, for example, cleanliness, ventilation system closures, etc., storage of flammable and other items, materials, and the crew's knowledge of their duties if a fire was to occur. For our next story, on the 19th of May, US lawmakers introduced the Clean Ferries Bill, a proposal aimed to eliminate diesel-powered ferries emissions across New York State. The bill requires publicly funded ferry operators to purchase only zero-emission vessels starting in 2028, with all public vessels in state waters required to be zero-emission by 2032. It also directs the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority to study charging infrastructure along major waterways, including the Hudson River. Supporters say the measure targets a major source of pollution in New York's transportation sector, where ferries contribute significant nitrogen oxide emissions linked to poor air quality and health risks. They argue the transition would reduce asthma and other respiratory illnesses while supporting the state's climate goals. Research by T&E had found that ferries in port cities like Barcelona, Dublin, and Naples are responsible for more toxic air pollution than all the cars in those cities. In our next report, the Black Sea MOU said that in 2025 the average detention percentage rose to 6.78%, the highest level recorded since 2007. In its Port State Control Annual Report 2025, the Black Sea MOU said its member authorities carried out a total of 5,117 inspections, representing an 11.6% increase compared to 2024. This remains approximately 3% below the 10-year average of 5,274 inspections under the new inspection regime, which began in 2016. The reporting period was marked by the ongoing armed conflict between the Russian Federation and Ukraine, which continued to pose serious risks to the safety and security of crews and vessels operating in the region. Due to the ongoing war, exact data on the number of individual ships operating in the region was unavailable. As a result, data for the broader region was not accessible. Therefore, for the purposes of this analysis, it has been assumed that throughout the year, vessels calling at Ukrainian ports also visited at least one port in other member states. Based on this assumption, the regional inspection rate for 2025, calculated as individual ships inspected as a percentage of individual ship visits, was determined to be 74.74%. Out of 5,117 inspections conducted last year, 3,596 of them were found with deficiencies, corresponding to a deficiency rate of 70.3%. This represents the second highest rate recorded since the establishment of the Black Sea MOU on PSC, exceeded only by 72.4% in 2007. In 2025, a total of 21,973 deficiencies were recorded during the port state control inspections. The most frequently identified deficiencies were related to safety of navigation with 2,950 deficiencies, fire safety with 2,188 deficiencies, life-saving appliances with 2,022 deficiencies, working conditions with 1,845 deficiencies, and documents with 1,591 deficiencies. These five categories collectively accounted for 48.2% of all deficiencies recorded in 2025. A notable development in 2025 was the significant rise in the average detention percentage, which rose to 6.78%. This represents the highest level recorded since 2007 and the third highest since the establishment of the Black Sea MOU, with only 2007 with 8.16% and 2004 with 6.95% having higher rates. A total of 347 vessels were detained in 2025 due to result of deficiencies considered clearly hazardous to safety, health, or environment. These detained vessels were registered under 31 different flag administrations. The overall detention percentage in the region increased from 4.71% in 2024 to 6.78% in 2025, continuing its upward trend. Additionally, considering that several ships were inspected and detained more than once during the year, the regional detention rate in 2025 rose to 9.07%, marking the highest rate since the introduction of the new inspection regime. You can download the full report via bsmou.org. Next, an initiative to help the UK's marine sector become safer and reach decarbonisation goals has been launched. The UK Maritime Innovation Hub, a service of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency, will be providing coordinated access to regulatory engagement for organisations developing innovative maritime technologies. The core themes that the UK Maritime Innovation Hub will focus its regulatory engagement and support for innovation include maritime autonomous surface ships, decarbonisation, including energy efficiency and alternative fuels, digital systems and digitalisation technologies, and nuclear propulsion. You can find out more via www.iaams.org.uk. For our next story, India's Directorate General of Shipping has completed its preliminary investigation into the sinking of the Liberian-flagged container vessel MSC Elsa 3, which went down in May 2025 off the Alappuzha coast in Kerala, India. The incident triggered significant marine pollution, with debris and contaminants spreading across multiple stretches of the southern Indian coastline, including areas between Vizhinjam and Kochi. The inquiry report was submitted as an affidavit before the Kerala High Court. According to the findings, the sinking resulted from a combination of critical technical failures and systemic management lapses. The vessel's ballast water system with integrated healing correction failed during the voyage, allowing progressive flooding into ballast tanks. This was compounded by defective machinery, delayed spare parts supply, inadequate maintenance procedures, and weak safety management systems. Investigators also highlighted insufficient crew training and poor emergency preparedness, noting that many crew members had theoretical knowledge but lacked hands-on experience. The ship had shown a persistent tilt in earlier voyages, and during the final journey it developed a severe list of about 26 degrees, causing container stacks to shift and eventually fall overboard before the vessel sank. The report further noted that multiple previously identified defects had not been properly repaired, with temporary fixes contributing to recurring system vulnerabilities. A delayed and inadequate crew handover also worsened onboard crisis management, as the chief officer had joined shortly before the incident. These factors collectively led to uncontrolled flooding, structural instability, and eventual capsizing. In parallel proceedings, the Kerala High Court allowed three of the seven foreign crew members to return to their home countries, subject to strict conditions including bonds, bank guarantees, and an undertaking to cooperate with ongoing investigation and testify when required. The court observed that foreign nationals cannot be detained indefinitely as witnesses. The remaining crew members' requests will be considered after further judicial review, while the investigation into the causes of the sinking and the resulting environmental damage continues. Up next, the Black Sea MOU has released a report into the 2025 Concentrated Inspection Campaign on Ballast Water Management. The campaign was carried out from the 1st of September 2025 to the 30th of November 2025, and it was conducted in conjunction with the Paris and the Tokyo Memoranda. It was also conducted under the campaign coordination of the Maritime Administration of Turkey. A total of 775 inspections were carried out covering 736 individual ships. Among these, 624 inspections were conducted using the CIC questionnaire. During the CIC, 76 ships were detained in total. Of which, 52 detentions were the result of inspections with CIC questionnaires and 16 of them were detained directly attributed to CIC-related deficiencies. A total of 59 questionnaires recorded at least one non-compliance response, representing 9.4% of CIC inspections. The overall average rate of non-compliances was 1.51%, reflecting the proportion of the unsatisfactory answers in relation to all applicable questionnaire responses. The analysis indicates that non-conformities identified during the CIC were largely focused on a limited number of areas, with approximately 89.3% of all recorded non-compliances relating to three specific questionnaire items, including the operational condition of ballast water management systems, the proper completion of the ballast water record book, and crew familiarization with the ballast water management plan. No non-compliant CIC inspections were recorded for ships aged 0 to 10 years and no CIC-related detentions were observed for ships aged over 35 years. Ships aged between 15 and 25 years accounted for more than half of the non-compliant responses and 62.5% of CIC-related detentions. You can read the report via the IIAMS website in the news section. In our next segment, the Cargo Incident Notification System has published a new guide on transporting lithium-ion cells and batteries in containers by sea. SIN's guidelines for shipping lithium-ion cells and batteries in containers provide shipping companies, operators and carriers with safety guidance for the transport of lithium-ion cells and batteries, classified under UN numbers 3480 and 3481, in cargo transport units. Lithium-ion cells are the primary elements of a battery and can exist in various forms, and they are commonly used in portable electronics and electric vehicles and are able to accumulate, store, and release electrical energy through the movement of lithium ions between a positive and a negative electrode. Lithium-ion cells and batteries must be handled with care, as they pose several risks if damaged, improperly charged, or exposed to extreme conditions. They are classed as dangerous goods because of several hazardous properties. These properties include fire hazard, chemical reactivity, toxic emissions, explosion risk, electrical hazard, and environmental risk. Within the document, SINS provides guidance on packaging, preparation for transport and ship loading considerations of lithium-ion cells and batteries. You can download the document via www.cinsnet.com. And for our final story, the World Maritime University and the International Maritime Organization have jointly published a new handbook focused on integrating gender perspectives into the maritime sector. The handbook, titled The Handbook on Gender Mainstreaming in the Maritime Sector, was released to coincide with the International Day for Women in Maritime, according to the IMO. The document was written by WMU Professor Momoko Katada, who this year received the IMO Gender Equality Award. According to the source, this publication is the first of its kind and aims to address persistent gender inequality in the global maritime industry. The handbook notes that women represent only 1% of the world's seafaring workforce and hold just 19% of ministerial positions responsible for maritime affairs. It was launched during an event held at IMO headquarters in London, marking the 2026 International Day for Women in Maritime. The publication provides practical guidance for maritime administrations, shipping companies, ports, shipyards, and maritime education institutions. It covers how to integrate gender considerations into policies, recruitment, training, workplace safety, and leadership development. The handbook also includes tools tailored for maritime organizations to conduct gender analysis, develop gender equality action plans, and carry out monitoring and evaluation. That's all we have for this month. Thanks for listening.